how we would have actually been how we would have broken up. But I have a feeling, my memory is that we would have been I guess as a second lieutenant I would have commanded something about the size of a platoon. I would have been in charge of 30 soldiers, give or take, probably with a sergeant and a lance corporal.
Mr. Roth, Real 10. Now, we were talking about this corps, Civil Defence Corps, and the idea for a mobile defence corps, the stillborn idea, as far as it, although it was in place.
Oh, it was all in place.
You expressed scepticism about this. Now, what were you exactly sceptical about? Why didn't you think this would work, or what was wrong with it?
Well, what seemed to be the basic flaw, and I did actually ask this question, and it was not a very popular question. The flaw seemed to me, the theory was that, as I say, we would mobilise in our various places, and mine was Salisbury Plain, others I think were the Brecon Beacons and so forth. But to me, the problem was that the press were then saying that you would have about 4 minutes warning of a nuclear attack, if you recall, perhaps you don't. And so I said to myself, if it's only got 4 minutes, I'm not even going to get out the front door before. So I asked about this, and the answer that was given was that, yes, but you see, although they're talking about 4 minutes, there would be a deteriorating diplomatic position. It would be getting more and more hairy, and one thinks, of course, of the Cuban missile crisis, I suppose. And so they said, in fact, you know, that it would be more than 4 minutes, and there would be time to get you to Salisbury Plain. And I remember asking, and it was a fairly senior officer, sort of major or half colonel, and I said, but with the greatest respect, if I was the president of Russia, and we were beginning to saber rattle at each other, I said, if I was suddenly appraised by intelligence that the Prime Minister in England was mobilising all his mobile defence corps and they were all being sent out to Salisbury Plain, I said, I would say to myself, they're about to fire nukes at us, and so I'd fire mine. And I never got an answer to it. He said, I don't accept that question. I'm not prepared to answer that question. He said, I really don't think that takes us any further. And I said, well, with great respect, I think it does.
So in other words, it would be just the mobilisation of this would be a provocative gesture.
Well, it seemed to me that it would be a step that you would take when you really began to think there was going to be a war. And it seemed to me to be the flaw in it. Having said that, of course, assuming that one was mobilised and then the nuclear attack came, I think one would have been a modest use. I mean, you would have been a disciplined force with a bit of basic first aid. But when you think of the kind of level of devastation, I can't really think that there would have been that much to salvage. Not in this country. I mean, it might be different in the United States, where they've got rather greater geographical areas. But I think this country would have, under a nuclear attack, would have been...
I was wondering how far they could get you in the training of all those different subjects of rescue and firefighting.
Well, it was all very basic, you see.
In just a month?
Very basic. I mean, how to use a stirrup pump, you know, and slightly beyond putting on a sticky plaster, but pretty basic, pretty basic.
I'm wondering, in the context of the sort of fires you could be facing with stirrup pumps and the sort of wounds and damage
to
people.
Absolutely.
What about radiation? Was that mentioned, or was there any element of what to do about radiation, any element of protection for yourselves?
I assume, as I say, of course, remember, we never mobilised. We never actually came together as a unit. I assume that there would be some kind of protective gear and Geiger counters and so forth when you mobilise, but if it was there, I never saw it because we never mobilised. And yes, the training was fairly basic.
And what about the question of leaving your family? I mean, because one of these things that there is that if you have to go to Salisbury, that means you have to leave
Absolutely.
Your family. In your case, who are only a couple of miles
Absolutely.
From Portsmouth.
Absolutely.
Was anything discussed
well,
about
it? Well, it was assumed that you would report, but I'm not in the least bit sure that confronted with, you know, if it was really obvious that a nuclear war was coming, I have a feeling that a great many would have said, no way.
Did you ever get as far as thinking it through for yourself, what you'd have done? I mean, obviously, you know, but for instance, during the Cuba crisis, only 5 years later, I mean, did you actually think of what you'd do?
No. And of course, the interesting thing is that although the Cuban crisis got pretty critical, we never got a mobilization order.
Were you expecting one, or half expecting one, or had it all been? Because 5 years is a long time as
yeah.
well.
I have to say, I went through the whole of the Cuban crisis with a slight sense of unreality. I don't remember being seriously deeply afraid. I have a slight sense of unreality, but that I have to say that every time that I have found myself in a seriously dangerous situation, I find that I tend to get this slight sense of unreality, which I have a sneaking suspicion might be a psychological kind of defence mechanism to cope. I may be wrong about that, and I've never actually discussed that with anybody, but I was certainly thinking of the riot in Trichomo and the other occasion being chased down the road by all the women. My overwhelming recollection is a sense of unreality, you know, and this isn't really happening to me.
Now, so I think the next thing then is your demobilisation. Now, this would be in June 58,
yes.
Either formally or... Now,
yes.
What was the demobilisation process as far as you were concerned?
I was, of course, on this civil defence course in Epsom, and what happened is, on the morning of your demob, you went and handed in your equipment, the equipment that you would not be taking. I mean, your uniform, of course, you kept, because that was personal to you, and you would take that. But you handed in, I remember, because one of the things that I didn't have was a gas mask, because that had, when my gear was sent back to me from Cyprus, one of the things that never appeared was the gas mask. And the quartermaster at Epsom was going to charge me for a gas mask. And I got very indignant about that. And I went out onto one of the bomb sites, because they had all these specially constructed sites that you practice on, picked up a gas mask that was lying on it, and took it in and banged it on the counter. And he said to me, "You just gone and got that from outside?" I said, "Yes." I said, "And it's a gas mask." I said, "And my gas mask went missing in Cyprus when I was on active service, and if you..." "Oh, that's right." And then he said to me, he said, "Well, I'm not sure that you'll be demobilised." I said, "You just try and stop me." And I said, if you're a half a quartermaster, you'll put that gas mask through and forget it. But I'm off. That was my demob.
Now, how did you get back into your civilian life? Because you had these family problems, which I presume hadn't immediately gone away. And you go back to your career in the law. Well, did you have problems getting back into civilian life?
Not that I particularly recall. Of course, I was partially helped by the fact that I had been living at home in the final part. But I was demobbed on a Thursday. I came home and I started work back in the firm of solicitors that I'd been articled in on the following Monday. I don't remember any great problems in adjusting.
You went on in your legal career. You're a judge now.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you want to sketch out very briefly the career you path you took. I don't know whether
it did. Well, it was weird. It's very untypical. If you very briefly, I came back into private practice. I started to practice, and then in 1965, the post of registrar of the local county court came up because the then registrar was retiring on age. I, by this time, was very much enjoying all the court work, and I'm slightly tongue-in-cheek, applied for it, and to my amazement, I got it, and it was mainly because there were five candidates for it, and the other four were all older than me, but they were sort of conveyancing and probate-type solicitors, and I was the only one of the five who really had been practicing in the divorce courts and in the county court. And so they decided that I was the only one who actually knew much about it. So I got the appointment 3 weeks after my 33rd birthday, which is a bit of a record, I think. And then after that, I left private practice and I got a job as a prosecuting solicitor for the Hampshire Police Authority, and I doubled up the two jobs, which is a rather curious combination. And in 1972 became a full-time registrar, then was appointed a recorder, and appointed a judge in 1984.
and still are. the reason for asking that is, do you feel that in any way the 2 years you'd spent out had in military service had either helped you or hindered you, either mentally or physically, whether it had been good or bad for you in any of those ways?
It was in no way was it adverse as far as my legal career was concerned, because I was qualified and I knew the job was waiting for me, because while I was away in the army, my former principal wrote and said, my partner is emigrating to Australia, would you like to come back in with me? So my legal career was not in any way adversely affected. And I think, in hindsight, I think it was a rewarding experience. I think it, I had a particularly fairly active national service, perhaps better than most in the sense that I didn't rot in a camp up in Didcot, you know, and come home every weekend and bored out of my mind. It was a fairly active national service, and I think a lot of experiences came out of it.
Do you think that the military training you'd undergone and the experiences, you know, under discipline had been of any value to you in your legal work at all or in the way you organise your life?
I think it gave you a perspective of people and particularly vis-à-vis prisons, which of course the majority of prison officers, certainly in those days, and I think to a great extent still are of course ex-army NCOs. So I think in that sense, but broadly speaking, no. I mean, I think the military life is so different. It's so different to civilian life that I don't think it taught you a great deal. But I think it was an interesting experience, and I've never regretted a day of it. I think at the time I fretted a bit, you know, you thought. But no, I never regretted a day of it, really, and I found it fascinating and some marvellous insights into human nature, you know, particularly among the soldiers. I remember them all. I had an enormous respect for the British soldier, I really did, because he was absolutely buggered about. You know, he really, really was, and he never lost his sense of humour, and he just sort of shrugged and soldiered on, you know, and always somebody would come up with an absolute brilliant witticism at some moment. I have great respect for the average British soldier. I think he was pretty good. And the average national serviceman, he was pretty good.
Thank you very much.